Be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin back with you again after a week's absence with another edition of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I hope you all had a very pleasant Memorial Day weekend, and I guess we're now looking forward to Independence Day. We sort of stagger from one holiday to another, I guess. Today I am going to repeat my request that you ask questions over the phone. We did actually have several people who tried. There was a glitch, and basically all those who tried to get through and were unable to do so last week, hopefully will be able to do so this week. Again, if you do attempt to call me and you don't get any joy, then please don't hesitate to email me to let me know that you tried to call in, because since I actually haven't had any calls since our system went out a few weeks ago, I have to sort of prove to myself that this thing actually does work again. So please feel free to email me if you try to call me at our toll-free number and fail to get through. The number, by the way, here is 888-873-4643. Let me repeat the number once more, 888-873-4643. When you call this number, you will be received by our engineer, Eric, who will put you on hold, and I will be notified, and I will then take your call at an opportune moment. Okay, what I'm going to do today is something that will take a lot of time, and I hope you enjoy it. I am going to introduce you to some new concepts that probably few of you have ever heard of, in an effort to prove to you that it is not speculation which has been driving oil prices. Now, we've had a lot of polemic about this whole business of the wicked speculators that have driven up oil prices like there was no tomorrow. As a seasoned futures trader, I have been extremely doubtful of that. And I will set about proving to you today that that is not the case, that there are other elements which are at work, and I will also explain to you what the speculators do. And this should take probably most of the session today, but it's very important for you, ladies and gentlemen, to understand this, because you have to know that every time we see these bubbles, they always burst and the market always goes back down where it came from. And the people that always talk about these fantastic prices ahead are always discredited, but people always forget that they've been discredited. And so the game goes on, and the new bubble comes, and new people spring up and make ridiculous claims, and they're discredited and then promptly forgotten about. And this is a sort of cycle that goes from strength to strength, and we need to put an end to it, and certainly the listeners to the Richard Martin's Wake Up Call will have an opportunity to gather the intellectual firepower which they will need to do just that. We'll talk about this in a second. Let me just give you my information, get that out of the way. Again, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. You can email your questions if you don't feel inclined to speak out over the air. And if you'd like to email me, you can do so by writing to R. Martin at gfcorporation.com. I will repeat that. I used to say you had to write in all lowercase. Apparently, you do not. So you can write in whatever case tickles your fancy, but you must write the word corporation out in full. And please note that the GS stand for Global Strategic. That's the company where I work in Miami, Global Strategic Investments. And once again, therefore, is the email. Here it goes. rmartin at gscorporation.com. Okay? If you'd like to call me directly out of this hour at any other time of your choice, you may also do so privately by calling me on my direct line at 305-357-5575. Now, again, the number is 305-357-5575. And that number you can use at any time. And if I am unavailable, I will, of course, call you back. But if you have questions or concerns or problems, I would be glad to do what I can to help. Once more, the toll-free number for your calls right now on the air, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to pass a conundrum by me, I will attempt to unravel it. The number here is 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. And our engineer is standing by to take your calls. Okay, before we start, just let me draw your attention to a new book which has come out. It's by Charles Morris, and it's called The $3 Trillion Meltdown. It's all about a description of the hideously complex financial securities that have brought the credit system to collapse. It has many excellent qualities besides brevity. It's less than 200 pages long. It is a comprehensive account. It's jargon-free. Quite frankly, it's a remarkable story. In the 10 years to the beginning of 2007, Americans borrowed a staggering $9 trillion against their home equity. This surge of credit greatly contributed to the prosperity that Anglo-Saxon economies have enjoyed over the past decade. Yet credit was plentiful only because lenders had abdicated their traditional role. Bankers discovered how to package loans, insure them, and sell them off. As a result, the credit system turned into a game of hot potato. But last summer, the music stopped, and Bear Stearns, a Wall Street bank that had been particularly aggressive in the mortgage field, was left holding the hot potato. By February, the prospect of Bear's bankruptcy sent the financial world into convulsions, and the Federal Reserve was forced to embark on a multi-billion dollar bailout. While the financial crisis is not just about souring mortgages provided to the least creditworthy American homebuyers, subprime loans are a fitting symbol of what went wrong. Creditors might normally be expected to have two thoughts uppermost in their mind: the return of principal and the receipt of sufficient interest to cover prospective losses. This was not the case with subprime loans. The fact that these had little prospect of being repaid bothered no one. Everyone in the credit system, the home appraisers, mortgage brokers, lending banks, Wall Street firms that acquired bundles of mortgages and sold them on, rating agencies that stamped these securities with their investment grade imprimatur, as well as the hedge funds that snapped up the riskiest slices of debt, was primarily concerned with fees. This encouraged reckless and predatory lending. Morris points out that the new credit system actually favored riskier loans because they meant higher rates and produced more spread for market participants to play with. When the American housing market turned down, lenders turned to financing leveraged buyouts, the subprimes of the corporate world. Clever bankers even found a way to create debt securities when there was no bona fide borrower. Frankenstein securities, which replicated real loans, were constructed out of credit insurance contracts. The supply of credit became infinite, utterly divorced from its traditional role of allocating scarce capital. Financial profits and bankers' bonuses soared. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, repeatedly praised such financial innovation. He said that risk was better understood and better distributed and hailed a, quote, new paradigm of active credit management, end of quote. His Panglossian view, markets could be left to regulate themselves, blinded him to increasingly dubious activities in the credit markets. Well, there's a little foretaste of things to come, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, the name of the book, The Trillion Dollar Meltdown, by Charles Morris. Okay. Well, let's see. Let me talk a little bit about, in general, about the history of oil and really what this is all about. In the early 1970s, there was no free market in oil. Much of the exploration, supply, and refining was dominated by a few large oil companies whose production concessions were bound up in the entire fortune of individual countries. Oil was sold at the government selling price to those same companies, and it was rarely traded on the open market. It moved from their oil wells, in their ships, to their refineries, to the gas pumps. The ability of the system to react and respond to changing conditions was minimal. The world's biggest commodity was the one that was the least subject to free market pressures. At the time it forced prices up, OPEC controlled about 70% of the world's exported oil. Its leverage was immense. It was all-powerful. The fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979 provoked another serious spike in prices. But it was political risk, not OPEC's stranglehold, that did the damage. The episode served, however, to entrench in people's minds the extraordinary power of OPEC. The truth, though, was becoming quite different. Since 1974, an entirely new structure has arisen in the global economy. The dominance of a few international oil companies was superseded by a new cast of players, the independent traders, who pioneered the creation of a free market in crude and products. They brought liquidity, efficiency, and market pricing to a commodity that had been in a cozy straitjacket since the days of Rockefeller. Their effect was gradually to change the nature of OPEC. The strict discipline of its first price coup in 1973 became replaced by regular cheating and production quota overruns. As with all cartels, the structure began to fragment as OPEC members tried, on the fringes, to cash in on the high price created by their initial collective action. A gradual deterioration in their plan culminated in Saudi Arabia introducing a new price formula in 1986, which prompted a total collapse in prices that December. Ever since then, OPEC has been more of a club than a cartel. It now handles only about 40% of the world's exports, and most of the countries are today producing exactly what they would be even if OPEC did not exist. For 20 years, OPEC has been NOPEC. The same structure that gives us $130 oil today gave us an average of about $30 for two decades. But as producers' power has slipped, their indignation has risen. Why, they say, should they not optimize their returns from this, and indeed the world's most precious resource? How indeed can they be overcharging when Mr. Brown can add 75% at the petrol pump? Could OPEC not just soften the blow a bit? The only country with enough capacity and flexibility to turn on the faucets is Saudi Arabia, but life isn't so simple. Oil comes in many different grades. It is not a uniform product. There are markets within markets for different qualities of crude oil and for the different products that emerge from a refinery, and anyway, there is a shortage of refining capacity. There is not enough of the lighter, low-sulfur crude the world wants, and there is enormous pressure on the supply diesel. Just turning on OPEC's faucets would not necessarily solve the current problem. The cause of high prices is not just OPEC. Global risk is probably a greater upward force than supply and demand. The fall in the US dollar has exaggerated the numerical hike, but more importantly, all commodities are at record highs. Speculation does not explain the current boom in commodities. Prices of commodities that are not accessible to investors, such as cobalt, tungsten, silicon, manganese, vanadium, molybdenum, cobalt, and cadmium, have all risen as much, if not more, than those of widely traded commodities, which do encourage and entertain the activity of speculators. Rhodium, for example, which has no ready liquid market, has just traded at all-time highs. Well, interestingly enough, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal entitled Oil Exporters Are Unable to Keep Up with Demand. And I'll just read you a part of this because I think it's very fascinating. The world's top oil producers are proving unable to put more barrels on thirsty world markets despite sky-high prices, a shift that defies traditional market logic and looks set to continue. Fresh data from the U.S. Department of Energy show the amount of petroleum products shipped by the world's top oil exporters fell 2.5% last year, despite a 57% increase in prices, a trend that appears to be holding true this year as well. There are several reasons behind the net export decline. Soaring profits from high-priced crude have fueled a boom in oil demand in Saudi Arabia and across the Middle East, leading less oil for export. At the same time, aging fields and sluggish investments have caused exports to drop significantly in Mexico, Norway, and most recently, Russia. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries also cut production early last year and didn't move to boost supplies again until last fall. In all, according to the Energy Department figures, net exports by the world's top 15 suppliers, which account for 45% of all production, fell by nearly a million barrels to 38.7 million barrels a day last year. The drop would have been steeper if not for heightened output in less developed countries such as Angola and Libya, whose economies have yet to become big energy consumers. End of quote. So you see, we not only have strong demand, we have an ongoing supply problem. The world's top 15 exporters are shipping 1 million barrels a day less in 2008 than in 2007. So I would ask you, ladies and gentlemen, where do the speculators fit into all this? You can see perfectly well that so-called commodities speculation is a symptom of much larger, a much larger set of problems. And I'll just list some of them for you. There's fractional reserve lending, which puts more credit into the system available for the purchase of oil. And we've talked about fractional reserve lending before, so some of you will know what that is. The previous monetary inflation has left a residue of money which is freely available to purchase this oil. You have the Fed's willingness to blow bubble after bubble after bubble that we've talked so much about. You have loose lending standards by the Fed, which are currently exacerbating the credit problems that we have. The carry trades in Japan, and finally runaway spending by Congress. So all that encourages the price to rise. And again, these so-called speculators really don't get a look in on that score. And by the way, all those points I mentioned pertain to other central bankers and foreign governments as well. As I've mentioned so many times, the Fed openly encouraged speculation in the wake of the dot-com crash. You know, Greenspan was the biggest cheerleader for both derivatives and adjustable rate mortgages. The result was the biggest housing bubble the world has ever seen. So you see, although monetary inflation is benign now that we've talked about, The pass-through effects of past monetary inflation are still being felt, and they, of course, are largely responsible for the buying power, which pushes up the price of oil, which I may say is crashing as we speak. We're down $4 a barrel at the lows of the day, and this may be the top. The American Airlines has just called off a delivery on several airliners. They're going to reduce the passenger availability. They've made several enormous statements about future plans, which they're shelving, which so frequently coincides with a top in a given commodity market when the major recipients of the commodity behave in this way. But we'll just have to see whether this is the top or not. I assure you, if it is the top, people will forget about peak oil, they'll forget about $200 a barrel, and they'll forget about the poor speculators who'll just turn their attention to something else. You know, the truth is, if you let the price of oil rise through the roof, the producers can hedge against a really high price and know that they're set for the next few years. They can get very aggressive. They can go out and explore for more because they know the price is locked in for them high enough to make a profit on things that were too risky before. So if this is the top, what I've just told you could, in fact, keep prices down for several years. Very few people will know this, but I'm sure that if you're listening carefully, you will be able to reflect this in your thinking and your conversations with other people. You know, free markets, and that's what we're really talking about here, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the concept of free markets. And this is what free markets are, what this country was predicated on. The idea that people have the right to buy and sell what they want, when they want, and how they want. And the wonderful thing about free markets, actually, is that they ration supply according to demand. You know, if you operate at an official level and government step in and sort of tamper with the markets, all that happens is that you end up with bizarre effects and artificial shortages. You know, when they talk about price gouging, now that's an odd term. You know, take what we have here in Florida. Take the example of hurricanes. Well, right before a hurricane, you know, a sheet of plywood is more valuable than it would be, say, 6 weeks earlier. Right after a hurricane, food, water, generators, they may be much more valuable. The consumer, if they happen to notice that prices go up during hurricane seasons, might try planning ahead a little. You know, in that way, they're ready and the price will not rise so steeply. Apparently, in New Zealand, you are required by law to keep 3 months' worth of food on hand. You know, now that could be urban legend or it could, you know, trouble libertarians. But, you know, the logic of being ready is compelling. You know, high prices gouge poor planners. You know, we heard about how silver was leaping up in 1980 and caused by the Hunt brothers. You know, but this was mostly paper silver, that contracts of silver trading on the futures market. And the argument about paper silver driving the physical market is interesting because there's a difference between silver and energy. It is supply and demand which basically drive the market, not wages on price. And the curious aspect of precious metals market is that you can very much alter the supply-demand curve with paper, that's to say buying futures contracts. You know, in this instance, the paper market subverted real demand. In a sense, the paper market in oil, which we also have, also subverts real demand, although not much, because really nobody wants to buy barrels of oil and put them in their 401ks or safe boxes. So in a sense, if I can buy a future paper contract in something, it will cause me to stay away from the real supply-demand curve. There will be no false demand to be unwound later, only a future contract to be unwound later. Now, look, I know this is all very, very sort of complex. Anybody who thinks it's simple is either very knowledgeable or underestimating, you know, the complexity of this thing. You know, does demand, as mandated by the health and growth of global economies, drive the price? Well, yes, it does. What about supply, as mandated by geology and politics? Does that drive the price? Obviously, it does. You know, for those who are big believers in the geological limits of energy and the potential catastrophe of oil alternatives, they must be energy bulls. You know, when those facts appear to be wrong, then I assure you they will change their models very abruptly. All right, now what I'm going to do right now is I am going to explain how the futures markets work in just a little detail. I used to be in charge of the world's largest commodity futures company's office in Paris for several years. So I'm somewhat knowledgeable in this, which might make me sort of go a little bit ahead of where real elementary knowledge lies. But, you know, we need to deal with this business of speculators, ladies and gentlemen, because it's really not fair. You know, when looking for a scapegoat for all these price rises. By the way, oil is now down $4.50 a barrel. So as we speak, we're accompanying really what amounts to a mini crash in oil and could turn into something much bigger as the afternoon goes by. So this is quite exciting. Whenever the people look for the scapegoat, they're always looking at the speculators. It happens every single time. You know, it's really easy. You don't need to know what you're talking about. You just say the wicked speculators are pushing up the prices. Well, here's a concept that you might want to know. In the futures market, what happens is that the price of commodities is traded in what are known as contracts. In other words, one person will buy a contract from another person who obviously will sell it to them. Okay? Every contract must be offset against another contract. But each side of the contract can have what are called open positions. Now, let's take the case of oil. Let's assume that in the oil market, we have a brand new market and there's nobody trading, no buyers, no sellers. And as the price moves, let's say the price is $100 a barrel. And nobody's interested in buying and nobody's interested in selling. Now, let's say the price goes to 101. Still no takers. 102. No takers. But at 103, there's somebody who wants to sell and somebody who wants to buy. Okay, so we'll call the buyer A, and the seller B. Now, they haven't traded any oil. All they've done is to take a contract which promises that B will sell to A one barrel of oil at $103 on a given date, which we'll say, for the sake of argument, is August the 1st, okay? So now we have A who has a buy contract. A has undertaken to buy a contract of oil from the market, from the NYMEX, through B, who has sold it to the market. B didn't sell directly to A, but B sold it to the market, and the market found A to buy from B. So what do we have now? We have two contracts open. We have A's open contract to buy and B's contract open to sell. Those contracts traded through the NYMEX, the New York Mercantile Exchange market in New York. So now we have what is called an open interest of two contracts. Now, let's say that the price goes up the following day to $104 a barrel. Okay? So, on that day, one of two things can happen. If A wants to close the position that he bought at 103, and he can find a buyer at 103, he can close his contract. If he does so, let's say, for the sake of argument, that B wants to close his position too because he realized he was wrong. He sold the contract short at 103. Or sold it at 103, it's gone to 104, and he thinks, oh, well, it's probably going higher. Okay, so they simply close the deal they made the previous day. B buys from A the contracts that they sold and bought the previous day. So now we have an open position of zero contracts. Remember, the previous day we had two contracts, A's buy contract and B's sell contract, so we had two open contracts. An open position of two contracts. Now, let's take an alternative scenario on that day, on the second day when oil is now trading at 104. Okay? A continues to want to sell, just like he did, but B doesn't want to sell. Okay, so what we have now is A selling, and B, who doesn't want, B doesn't want to buy to close his contract. He wants to maintain his contract that he sold at 103. But we do have a new buyer who's come in at 104 to buy, who is buyer C. So now, A has sold his contract to C, to buyer C. Okay, so now we have C, we have the contract that was originally open and is still open with B, and the new contract with C. So now we have, again, two contracts, because B has simply been replaced by C. Now, let's say the following day, the contract, the position goes to 105. Now it's trading at 105, at which point A and C want to stay with their positions, but two new people come in. D, buyer D, decides he wants to come in at 105, and there's a seller called E. So now we have D and E transacting at 105, and we have now the original contracts, C and A, plus D and E. That gives us a total of four open contracts. In other words, the open interest is now four. Now, let's say on the following day, nobody wants to change their positions, but the price has gone to 106, and now F decides that he'd like to come into the market because F thinks it's going much higher. But G thinks 106 is the top, so he wants to sell. So F buys from G, and now we have two more contracts in the market, so we have an open interest of six contracts. Well, let's say the following day, H decides to buy from I, so now we have eight contracts. So we've got all these people staying in the market, okay? But all these people who've decided that they want to stay in the market, and so the open interest in crude is growing, okay? Now, this is what I want you to know. Remember, you now know what happens in the futures markets. You know what open interest is. Of course, it's more than eight contracts. It's, you know, thousands and thousands of contracts of open interest which are in the market in oil, as you will appreciate. You should know that I'm quoting now from the New York Mercantile Exchange. And I quote, oil's rally to a record above $135 a barrel, this was yesterday, came as traders bought crude to cover wrong-way bets that prices would decline. Remember the in our original example? B, who had sold at 103, bought at 104 because he realized he was wrong, and that took our contract back to zero. He basically covered, okay, or bought back to cover the wrong way bet. In other words, 103 went to 104, so he lost a dollar. So traders bought crude to cover wrong way bets that prices would decline. The number of outstanding futures contracts, known as open interest, fell 8.1% in a week to 1.36 million at the same time that prices rose 2.6%. That comes from their data. Falling open interest and rising prices are signs that traders are buying to exit so-called short positions that would profit if oil had fallen, and they lose money as the prices rise. Okay? So I continue to quote from Stephen Schork, president of Schork Group in Villanova, Pennsylvania. He says, in a market like today, which is trending higher while open interest is falling, it's a sign that money is moving out of the market. Okay? Now, open interest in NYMEX crude futures peaked this year at 1.5 million on March the 13th. Okay? This is what's interesting, ladies and gentlemen. The open interest in crude oil has been falling for months. after the number of outstanding crude futures reached a record 1.58 million on July the 16th, 2007. So you see, you understand that if A and B and C and A and D and E in our example, and F and G, if those people are basically closing out their positions, thereby leaving the market with fewer people, you understand that speculators are not an important force in the market, because otherwise the open interest would be increasing as opposed to decreasing. Now, you see, very few people understand this. Very few people understand this. It's actually fascinating. I hope you find it as fascinating as I do, because anybody who knows what I have just told you would stagger back and say, wow, I never realized that that could be the case, that the price could go up as the number of contracts decrease. It normally, you understand, supply and demand is associated with increasing prices, not the other way around. Okay? You see, there needs to be a buyer and seller for each open contract, as I've explained. Falling open interest means money is leaving the market. The media has been accusing speculators of running oil massively higher. But the reality is that since July the 16th, 2007, money has been flowing out of the oil as speculators reduce their positions. Okay? So, I won't mention any more about that, but I hope it's really clear. I mean, I have proven to you that these poor, you know, malign speculators are absolutely not responsible. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what is responsible, so don't feel you're being left in the lurch here. But in the meantime, let me give out once more our toll-free number at the studio at Progressive Radio Network in case anybody wants to ask a question. And the number is 888-873-4643. Once again, give the number out, 888-873-4643. Feel free to call at any time. So, let's look a little bit to see what else might be causing prices to rise if it isn't these speculators. And by the way, as I mentioned in my last show, the speculators are essential for the smooth running and the liquid functioning of these markets. You know, if it were not for the speculators, I will tell you the market would be a lot higher. Because even if the speculators buy from, you know, the producers who are selling into the market or other commercial operators, because they want to make a profit, they could so easily be making a loss. In fact, any speculator today who was long in the market yesterday is losing a lot of money today if he didn't close out his position earlier in the day. So the speculators take enormous risk for the job they perform. And quite frankly, they're welcome to all the profits they make. Because as I'm sure you all know, ladies and gentlemen, the more liquidity there is in the market, the more stable is the market. And my feeling is that if it is a fact, as I have just told you, complete with figures and dates, that the speculators have been leaving the market, it may be that we should have been provided with a lot more speculators, because what speculators do as often as not, as the market rises, is they sell into the market because they think and hope that the market is hit a top. So if the speculators aren't there, the market can just go on and on and on up, illiquid as it may be. Now, let's have a look at some of the reasons why oil prices might be rising. Okay? First of all, we all know that there are limited areas available for offshore drilling. The planned rise of the standards for automobiles, CAFE, has been stopped, meaning that now we're going to see much more oil needed to feed automobiles than we would have if these environmental standards had been maintained. nuclear power generation of electricity has been restricted, as I'm sure you know. That adds to the oil demand. Federal Reserve policies since 2001 led to a very weak U.S. dollar, which in itself raises oil prices. There are absolutely no energy conservation policies really being pursued at this time, as I'm sure you all know. No incentives have been provided for hybrid automobiles, or few are available today. There's no major United States research and development on energy. Game-changing breakthroughs over the past decades in solar, battery, or energy generation technologies are non-existent. The efficiency standards for appliances have not been raised for decades. The Iraq and Afghanistan wars are contributing to Middle East tensions. Those standards I mentioned, the environmental standards for light trucks and SUVs, have been kept much lower than those for autos. This ridiculous corn ethanol policy has driven food prices higher as oil rises, that I mentioned, whereby corn, subsidies are given for corn to be used for ethanol as opposed to sugar, which is five times more efficient. But America doesn't want to buy the sugar from Brazil, where it is available in plentiful quantities. Mass transit is not a priority. There's no special capital gains treatment for any kind of alternative energy investment. Efficiency improvements for residential energy use have failed to have been aggressively promoted. And that is true also of the transmission of power and consumption. America has amongst the lowest gasoline taxes in the developed world, even though obviously they bellyache about the rise in prices. The price is about half what they are in Europe or less. There's limited hydroelectric power generation. A tax incentive called ADCS was created that encourages purchases of large inefficient vehicles. Aggressive tax incentives for battery technology development have simply failed to be to brought into play. Light trucks, SUVs, and pickups from the gas guzzler tax have been exempted. Just clean coal, including gas liquefaction from coal, has been discouraged. There are limited or non-existent state tax incentives for building energy-efficient homes. The compact fluorescent light bulb was never aggressively promoted. Tax credits for residential solar power have been allowed to expire. Americans on average, as we all know, live further away from where they work than Europeans do. There's no special capital gains tax treatment for clean energy technology development. I mean, I could go on and on and on, and all these things have a sharp upward influence on the price of oil. So, ladies and gentlemen, to blame the speculators, when the moat needs to be taken out of, the national eye, really seems to me to be very exaggerated, indeed, and quite out of place. I was reading an article by an energy analyst the other day who was bearing down on the sort of criminal behavior of speculators in the market. This lets you know why talking about speculation is so very important, And frankly, what bothers me is that as I find in every article that I've read to date, there is a notable absence of any effort to explain precisely how futures drive the physical market. What particularly aggravates me is statements such as the following from this analyst, and I quote, "In fact, index speculators have now stockpiled via the futures market the equivalent of 1.1 billion barrels of petroleum, effectively adding eight times as much oil to their own stockpile as the United States has added to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve over the last 5 years," end of quote. Well, I mean, that statement is moronic. Stockpiling futures, it seems as though he's trying to dismiss the need for stockpiling the physical commodity to drive the price by referring to future stockpiling. You know, this sort of fuzzy futures physical connection keeps reappearing. And then another quote here. Institutional investors have purchased over 2 billion bushels of corn futures in the last 5 years. Right now, index speculators have stockpiled enough corn futures to potentially fuel the entire United States ethanol industry at full capacity for a year. That's equivalent to producing 5.3 billion gallons of ethanol, which would make America the world's largest ethanol producer. End of quote. Well, I don't know about you guys, but my car is not fueled by corn or ethanol futures. I don't believe this is just a semantic point. I think it's evidence of ignorance and, quite frankly, at least very soft logic. This kind of thinking shows up again, and I quote again, turning to wheat, in 2007, Americans consumed 2.22 bushels of wheat per capita. At 1.3 billion bushels, the current wheat futures stockpile of index speculators is enough to supply every American citizen with all the bread, pasta, and baked goods they can eat for the next 2 years. End of quote. So there we go again, you know, talking about stockpiling futures for feeding people. I don't eat futures. You know, this is either hopelessly inarticulate or idiotic. And then this guy notes, and I quote, doesn't it seem likely that an increase in demand of this magnitude in the commodities futures markets could go a long way in explaining the extraordinary commodities price increases in the beginning of 2008? End of quote. Well, in short, no. I see no reason whatsoever. Could somebody please explain it to me? You know, he notes, and I quote, the huge growth in their demand has gone virtually undetected by classically trained economists who almost never analyze demand in futures markets. End of quote. Well, maybe there's a reason for this. Huh? And then he goes on. Index speculators' trading strategies amount to virtual hoarding via the commodity futures markets. Institutional investors are buying up essential items that exist in limited quantities for the sole purpose of reaping speculative profits. End of quote. Wrong again. They're not buying up limited quantities of anything. They are buying futures. Once they take possession of the commodity, which the author suggests is not necessary, then they will have purchased something. The supply-demand curve of the physical market remains unscathed. And you have to remember that 98% of all speculators close their contracts along the lines that I described when I gave you the example earlier on, and never take physical demand, delivery of anything. And half those speculators are selling short anyway, so one speculator is simply bet on the buy side by another speculator who's selling. And then I just, one more quote from this lunatic. Actually, I'll give you a couple more because it's important to know what these people are saying. Here's another one. If OPEC supplies the markets with more oil, it will have little effect on index speculator demand for oil futures. If Americans reduce their demand through conservation measures like carpooling and using public transportation, it will have little effect on institutional investor demand for commodities futures. Well, end of quote. I think those two statements are preposterous and quite indefensible, or at least they really need to find somebody who can defend them, because I don't know where that person is. You know, is he really saying the rates of supply and consumption, the classic supply-demand curve, don't influence the futures market? You know, there's a crucial distinction between traditional speculators and index speculators. Traditional speculators provide liquidity by both buying and selling futures. Index speculators buy futures and then roll their positions by buying calendar spreads, which means that when one of their contracts comes to fruition, they simply sell and simultaneously buy another contract for a month further out. You know, here's a real gem from this guy. Quote, think about it this way. If Wall Street concocted a scheme whereby investors bought large amounts of pharmaceutical drugs and medical devices in order to profit from the resulting increase in prices, making these essential items unaffordable to sick and dying people, society would be justly outraged. End of quote. Well, of course this is true. By this example, they bought the commodity, health products, not some future. This analogy illustrates how clueless the guy really is. And one final quote. Why is there not outrage over the fact that Americans must pay drastically more to feed their families, fuel their cars, and heat their homes? Index speculators provide no benefit to the futures markets, and they inflict a tremendous cost upon society. Individually, these participants are not acting with malicious intent. Collectively, however, their impact reaches into the wallets of every American consumer. Is it necessary for the U.S. economy to suffer through yet another financial crisis created by new investment techniques, the consequences of which have once again been unforeseen by their Wall Street proponents? End of quote. Well, maybe, but the case hasn't been made in a way that I can understand. You know, when Congress passed the Commodity Exchange Act in 1936, they did so with the understanding that speculators should not be allowed to dominate the commodity futures markets. And that they did. You know, when the Hunt brothers, interestingly enough, when the Hunt brothers pushed up the price of silver, which some of you will remember from 1980, they didn't buy silver futures. They bought silver. Now, silver went from, you know, $5 to $50 or $55 an ounce. If you were to forbid speculators from buying silver or any other commodity, and it was a fact that those speculators bought the commodity and forced the price up, don't you think that they'd go out there and just buy the physical instead? And who is going to prevent people buying physical? Now, it's true that in the 1930s, gold became outlawed for Americans who had to turn all their gold into the Federal Reserve, their nearest Federal Reserve Bank. But, I mean, this is nothing to do with speculation. This was in order for the government to be able to mess around with the price of gold and create inflation and print like there was no tomorrow and gradually start the process of getting rid of the gold standard, which finally expired, you know, 40 years later in 1971. Here is another explanation of some prices in the change of oil. And once we're done with this, I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, I won't bring it up anymore. But I think it's important for you to understand some of these concepts. You know, it's understandable that speculators are easily caught up in a tendency to compress all future demand from China, India, and elsewhere into current prices. But, you know, it may be helpful to remember that these countries didn't simply rise out of the sea in the past year. We need only to look back a year to remember that oil prices plunged from about $80 in the mid-2006 to about $50 early last year. Now, wide swings in commodities are nothing new. You know, if you sort of stare at a few historical commodities charts, you'll notice that commodities are particularly subject to vertical spikes and spectacular failures. Price trends in commodities often have a greater tendency to persist once they reverse compared with equities. You might recall a striking case of that a decade ago when crude experienced a steep plunge to just $12 a barrel. What offered a warning of the periodic plunges in oil prices during the 1990s and even just last year? A concept called contango. Now, normally, the oil futures curve is in what is called backwardation, which means that futures prices for distant delivery dates trade below the current spot price for oil. Occasionally, though, longer-term futures trades were above spot prices, even adjusted for interest rates and the cost of carry. Often a contango emerges during a period when the spot price of crude is declining, usually with a resulting acceleration in the decline, as we observed several times during the 1990s. In recent days, we've observed a contango develop between spot crude and futures expiring in 2010 and beyond. While the spreads between near-term futures have narrowed sharply and may also move into contango soon. This is worth monitoring. It is a sign that traders have accepted the bullish case so thoroughly that they have become frantic to bid up oil for delivery well into the future. Contango creates immediate incentives to buy oil for near delivery and store it in inventory. Producers don't particularly like markets in contango because that tendency to build inventories reduces their ability to control prices through their own actions. You know, just as stocks tend to be poor buys in overbought markets with extreme advisory bullishness, commodities tend to be poor buys when prices have already enjoyed a parabolic speculative rise and futures move into contango, with the caveat that the last few weeks of a speculative rise can be nearly vertical, so the ultimate highs are unpredictable. a few years ago, the tendency of oil prices to increase despite a mild contango made it appear that the relationship between contango and subsequent price weakness had vanished. But as the contango steepened in 2006 and early 2007, crude plunged from about $80 to nearly $50 a barrel. I emphasize this was just a year ago. We probably shouldn't assume that the world has suddenly changed so dramatically that the demise of fossil fuels and the extinction of mankind as a species has to be priced in by Labor Day and then continually revised so that prices form an even steeper parabola. While the notion of an inexhaustible resource encourages traders to think in terms of exponentially rising prices, the economics of exhaustible resources are well studied. The standard result is that if the level or growth rate of demand is generally known, the price of the commodity should tend to rise at approximately the rate of discount, i.e. about the risk-free interest rate plus a small convergence yield over time. When there is uncertainty compounded by adjustment costs, there will be a range of demand shocks that will not provoke a supply response, so prices may spike temporarily in response to those shocks, but those spikes will tend to revert back to the mean. Permanent shifts in demand will, of course, cause permanent shifts in price levels, but temporary shocks continue to induce mean reverting spikes and declines. Presently, we have low single-digit growth in world demand for oil, which is expected to be sustained over the long term. The main factors inducing short-term price fluctuations for oil are short-term fluctuations in demand and supply, amplified by speculation on both sides of the market. It's clear that the oil markets are characterized by very low short-run demand elasticity, that is, price changes don't have much effect in suppressing demand, as well as low short-run supply elasticity. Price changes don't immediately prompt increased supply, especially when there is not much production slack. That combination of inelasticities can certainly produce unusual price spikes over the short term, particularly when speculators get a theme in their teeth. But it should also be clear that oil demand responds cyclically to even moderate economic weakness, and that even moderate supply responses over the intermediate term can have a significant effect on prices. It is likely that we will observe some retrenchment in demand as the global economy softens. Notably, the Shanghai stock market has plunged by about 50% from last year's high, the Hang Seng dropped about 30% before a recent bounce, and stock markets around the world are clearly off their highs with the exception of Brazil and Russia due to the high weightings of resource stocks in those markets. So the signal from the equity market is that economic weakness is not likely to be isolated for the United States. Meanwhile, the EIA estimates that non-OPEC supply will increase by roughly 600 million barrels in the coming months. So, it looks like the combination of a developing contango in the oil futures curve, a weakening global economy, and the likelihood of a moderate but positive supply response in the months ahead makes it unlikely that oil prices will escape their cyclical tendencies beyond the summer months. So there you are, ladies and gentlemen. The fall in oil prices is ahead. Okay, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I will be back on Monday, 1 p.m. the usual time. Have a wonderful weekend. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye for now.